Hello, my name's Jane Dacre. Welcome to the second season of Medical Women Talking. The podcasts are made up of conversations with some amazing women doctors who've had incredible careers. Being a woman and a doctor can be challenging, but these conversations are designed to be shared to help those women aspiring to fulfilling careers and to leadership roles. We hear a lot of negative stuff about medicine these days, but these inspiring stories show us that medicine can still be brilliant. Listen and be inspired. Jeanette Dixon is the chair of the Academy of Medical Royal Colleges. She's a clinical radiologist by background and has had an incredible career in medical leadership.
I just wanted to start off by you giving me a bit of a summary of your career, just sort of edited highlights, and how did you end up where you are?
Okay, so the accent usually gives the game away that I was born north of the border. I'm Glaswegian. Like many Glaswegians, went to university in Glasgow and did some house jobs there. I am that old that I did the house jobs. And then it was a time when often jobs were 6 months long, and I wanted to get my MRCP. I knew I wanted to be an oncologist, but I needed an MRCP. So I wanted to get a rotation because I wanted to be able to study without changing job every 6 months. I managed to fail the part one MRCP first time, so I wanted some job security. So I applied for any job that was a 1 in 5 or quieter. Again, it was a very long time ago. And ended up, having had a few interviews, I ended up in Eastbourne. So I ended up on the train to Eastbourne, not actually knowing where Eastbourne was until I looked at the map in London, Victoria. They interviewed me, gave me a job. I went down there. I spent a while back there, got my membership first time around, the second part first time around. Knew I wanted to do oncology. Wasn't entirely sure where I wanted to do oncology. A job came up in Glasgow. Didn't think I would be shortlisted for the job, but I put in an invite anyway, an application anyway, just to get some interview practice, and went up for some interview practice and was offered a job. So that was about 15 months going 500 miles one way and then 500 miles another. At that time, although I got the registrar job and was looking forward to being a senior registrar, I was Calmanised. It was a run through training. And again, this was before there was an awful lot of money put into cancer in the early noughties. I wanted to be competitive because there was no guarantee of a job anywhere. And there was certainly no guarantee of a job where I thought I wanted to work in Glasgow. So I looked around for some research and managed to get an MD at the Paterson Institute in Manchester and did that, and then managed to get an interdeanery transfer down to finish off my training in London Northwest in Mount Vernon Cancer Centre, which is where I am now. I kept moving, and then suddenly decided that this was where it was going to be. Got the consultant job here. So been a consultant since 2002. And have always done something else in addition. I think it's really important to balance your work with something that you find gives you an opportunity to meet other people, to go out and to talk, to network with other doctors and other healthcare professionals. So initially did a lot of work in the educational space, worked my way up from clinical tutor, educational supervisor, clinical supervisor through training program director, and was the first head of school for clinical oncology for London and KSS deaneries, and then went into medical management and was the CD of the department. And then after a while doing that, I felt I needed something different. So my college, the Royal College of Radiologists, which is where clinical oncologists sit, advertised an officer post in professional standards, professional practice. And I did that and applied for that and was elected unopposed, which means nobody else wanted to do it at the time. And did that job and then went on to be the vice president for oncology and then the president of the radiologists. And then the academy chair came up and my colleagues were nice enough to elect me as the academy chair. So the theme of clinically, I'm a clinical oncologist. I treat patients with cancer with all treatment modalities, radiotherapy, all the drug modalities, but not surgery. And I predominantly treat lung cancer. So I've done that always as alongside every other role I've done. But the theme of the other parts of my career is much more about better patient care, but better patient care by better standards for doctors, better support for doctors, making, if you make doctors' lives easier, better, if you make them happier, you improve patient safety, you improve patient care. So it's improving patient outcomes, but by helping my colleagues.
Fantastic. So what an amazing career pathway. Can I just get you to cast your mind right back? Why did you become a doctor in the first place?
That's a sort of interesting one. So again, I'm not the first person in my family to go to university, but I was kind of the first one in the bit that spoke to each other that went to university. And there wasn't a lot of careers advice around at that point in time. So when it looked like I had good enough grades, good enough academic achievement to go to university, there wasn't a lot of ability to go, and this is what you should do. So, and this is what university is for. University is about education. So I kind of took the sort of naive view that when you went into university, you got a job at the end of it. And I thought medicine looked like an interesting job. My parents are both healthcare professionals, but it looked like an interesting job. And I thought it's a job that will never go out of fashion. There'll always be employment. It'll be a reasonable wage, so I'll be able to support myself throughout my life. My parents work in healthcare, so it's probably okay. So that's why I became a doctor. So it's slightly interesting route into medicine, I think.
It's also interesting that you talk about doing it because it was a secure job, a good mm-hmm. job. People now don't necessarily think that it's as good a job as you might have thought. And I assume that you're a bit caught in the thick of it now, in your position in the academy.
Yeah, I think it's a really tricky one. I would still recommend the job because I think the job is wonderful. I think the patients and that interaction with people and help, and much as it's a bit trite, or it sounds a bit trite to say helping people at some of the worst point in their lives, not necessarily getting them better, completely better or curing them, but actually helping them be the best they can be. At the moment, I think there is a lot of our colleagues who don't see that. And I think that's a real shame. I think as senior colleagues and senior leaders, I think some of that blame must sit with us. But I think a lot of it sits with the way that medicine has developed and the feeling that the NHS is not being funded appropriately, that doctors haven't been remunerated appropriately, that the way trainees are trained is not helpful for trainees. Some of that I can absolutely agree with. Some of it I think, well, some of the stuff that was brought in to help trainees that trainees complained about 20 years ago, i.e., having a good structured training, being able to see all parts of the curriculum, having access to all different types of hospital specialties, not being dependent on one person or one firm for a reference. I think the unintended consequences of that and the huge expansion of doctors we have seen is that we have taken away the camaraderie and the support and that genuine view for some of our colleagues that they are actually making a difference.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is interesting to hear a lot of younger people feeling burnt out. And you're right, in our day, somehow you had medical families to rely on, and those bonds don't seem mm-hmm. to be quite as strong as they were. So, yeah, I agree with you. But you went into you kept saying you always wanted to be an oncologist. Why did you always want to be an oncologist? I mean, it's dealing with some pretty tricky stuff.
I think the thing is, it's as you know, medicine is a hugely broad church. You take in huge numbers of people who are all different personalities. So it's great that we all like different things. When I went on the wards first as a clinical medical student, it was Glasgow. It was a deprived area. you always got taken to see patients with signs. So you do a your bedside, classical bedside teaching model, take a history from the patient, examine the patient. And it was the 80s, so you would have somebody with cardiovascular disease, or you'd have somebody with a pleural effusion generally. Those were the signs on the medical wards at that point in time. So you'd have somebody with atrial fibrillation, or somebody with bad hypertension, or somebody with congestive cardiac failure, or you'd have somebody with SVCO or a pleural effusion. And at the end of it, the teaching junior doctor, as they were, usually SHO or registrar, would say, so and so, yeah, you've got the diagnosis, he has congestive cardiac failure, this is what we're going to do. Or they've got atrial fibrillation, this is what we're going to do, and this is why we're going to do it. When it came to the cancer patients, it was like, well, we're sending them off to the cancer centre and we have no idea what happens there. And it was a recurring theme that nobody really knew what happened in the cancer centre. And I thought, I'd quite like to know that myself. And so I went and did an elective in the cancer centre. And I found that was true. Nobody really knew what happened, whether you were doing medicine or whether you were doing surgery. It was like a black box. And I'm one of those folk that, you know, you can't tell me something and then leave it and give me a hint and not show me the rest. So I kind of went and did an elective in the cancer centre and actually just liked the patients and liked the openness and honesty. At that point in time, you know, and it's still true often when you speak to patients and you say you've got cancer, they go, and when am I going to die? How long have I got to live? What's going to happen? Whereas if you say that to a patient with COPD or diabetes or congestive cardiac failure who has the same prognosis, they don't ask the same questions. And so certainly way back in the day when I started training, there was an honesty, which I really liked. I really like that direct, honest communication with patients. I liked the cards on the table. And I also liked then, when I got into clinical oncology, I really liked the radiotherapy. I liked the technical aspect of radiotherapy, the anatomy that you have to do to be able to plan radiotherapy. I really enjoyed the cutting edge. You know, the literature changes so frequently that you're actually doing, you know, things change within a year or two. So you have to be constantly learning. So again, it kept me interested. It kept me enthused. It kept me amused and stimulated in a way that other specialties, when I looked at them or when I was, you know, when I was rotating through them, just didn't do it for me.
So, I mean, clearly it was a good specialty for you and you've done incredibly well in your career. Have you had bumps in the road? Is there anything that you think might be helpful to share that would help younger people coming through?
I think that's a really tricky one, isn't it? When you look back, when we all look back, we tend to remember mostly the good stuff, don't we? Because we're human beings and we like the good stuff. So have there been bumps in the road? Yes, there have. So, you know, I mentioned earlier, I failed the first part of my membership. I struggled a wee while. I think I had two or three interviews before I got my first SHO job. I had to apply for two or three research posts before I managed to secure one for an MD. I think there was also much of my training I'd lived through a belief there wouldn't necessarily be many consultant jobs there. That changed very quickly. So I think part of those bumps are, you know, they're not the same when you look back on them, because tech, you know, there are a lot of, you know, there was always a lot of jobs out there. I was always going to get a job. It was just a question of where I was going to get a job, or if I was willing to compromise on the fact that I wanted a 1 in 5 or quieter because I wanted to study. So I think it's the bumps in the road have been what the ordinary bumps in the road you would expect. I don't think I've had a huge amount of major problems.
So that's pretty good. What about life outside medicine? It sounds you come across as someone with a lot of dedication to the cause. Do you have time for other stuff?
Oh yeah, yeah. I've got. I think the trick is also to make time for other stuff. I think you need to, you know, you talk about being dedicated, and that's lovely to hear, but there is that work-life balance. What is my work-life balance? Where do I enjoy it? So I, even with all the other roles I've done, I do prioritise going out with friends. I do prioritise visiting relatives and whatnot. So, you know, I very much enjoy baking, I enjoy cooking, I enjoy the cinema, I enjoy the theatre, I enjoy opera, I enjoy music, I enjoy socialising with friends. So there's all of that kind of thing. I do exercise regularly, which I don't enjoy very much, but it's very good for me. So I do it. But, you know, what I think one of the points at one point I realised that every time there was a chance to get a new job and move, it was either the new job or the boyfriend of the time. And I kind of chose to move most times. So I don't have a partner and I don't have kids. Is that because of dedication? Is that because of just the way the world is? Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there are some who might feel that it makes it a bit easier. I don't know.
Well, I mean, you don't have to please anybody but yourself, which may be the reason.
So you can, yeah, be as independent as you want to be, perhaps. I don't know. So in your current job, you've been thrust into the limelight at a very difficult time, and you're having to deal with the people that are running the country. So what does that feel like?
Well, you know that swan thing, where the swan looks very beautiful and elegant and relaxed above the water, but underneath the waterline, it's a slightly different story. It kind of feels like that a lot. And I think it's one of the interesting things is meeting people. One of the things, certainly with all of college existence and getting involved with the colleges, you meet people who are not doctors and who don't work in healthcare, and who sometimes have a lot of power over healthcare and sometimes understand it really well, but sometimes have very curious blind spots. So I like people and getting to know people and getting to understand people and what makes them tick. And this has provided opportunity for that. It's also brought out skills that I do have. So the things that in medicine we teach you, communication skills, holding risk, negotiation, complex systems, all of those skills come into play, I think, when you're meeting politicians, government, Department of Health, all of those things. But at the end of the day, it's making that connection, I think, with people and understanding that most of life is negotiation. And, you know, they have an agenda, you have an agenda. Can you align those agendas? Can you bring things together better? Because when you align an agenda, you almost inevitably get the best outcome.
And I suppose I know a little bit from experience, but aligning the agenda of all of the numerous different medical royal colleges and also the government is quite a tall ask, isn't it?
I wouldn't want a job that wasn't a challenge, Jane. I think it's not as different as it appears on the outside. I think, I've never met a doctor yet who doesn't want to come to work to do a good job and who doesn't want to make the patient's life better in some way. And that's not just the doctors who patient face, but those doctors who don't patient face, you know, want to do the same thing. Everybody wants the patients to be better, because at least we all know one day we too will be patients. I think what government often want is to make sure that they are getting the best for the patient for the money they're spending. And so it's that discussion around what does good look like, what can good look like, what should be there, what shouldn't be there. That and that open conversation, I think, is where you find that you're not as far apart as you think sometimes.
Sometimes. Very diplomatic answer. So throughout your career, I assume that you've been inspired, motivated by people, by events. Can you give us a little bit of an insight into what's inspired you to work in the way that you have done and to do the jobs that you have?
Again, I this is an interesting one, because if I go back and say, so why did I enjoy that job? It was often I found somebody there who spoke a language or spoke about patients in the same way that I perceive patients, or spoke about the service and the NHS and the service delivery in the same way I did. And I think, you know, the major first person I think was a role model was probably the CD when I was a registrar. So he in Glasgow, he had a lot of common sense. He was very pragmatic. At that time, there was a large number of folk in Glasgow. There was 20 odd consultants that time, which was a very big department. That's a relatively small department now. But they had come from different areas and they'd been trained in different ways. And he could say, well, that person was trained in that way because of the resource available in that area. So he opened my eyes to not just the patient in front of you, but the service or the other patients. And I think most of the time when I've really been struck by things, it's people taking my view from one patient in front of me to the bigger picture, the bigger service, the best bang for the most patients, all of that thing. So he started that off. And I think coming through all of the educational stuff, again, Wendy Reed, who was my initial sort of line manager when I was head of school in London, she was somebody who was very passionate about education, very passionate about education being important and being seen on the psychiatrists talk about parity of esteem. So everybody knows what research is. Everybody, you know, venerates academics, but who venerates those who train the next generation of doctors, who actually makes them professional? And I think Wendy was very passionate about that, and some of that rubbed off on me as well. I think coming through the college system, I've met an awful lot of folk from other specialties at a very high level. Some have been men, some have been women, but I think, you know, there's been an awful lot of people who feel passionately about their specialties and who feel passionately about the service that patients receive and improving the service that patients receive. So those people I have admired and respected and listened to and often taken advice from.
So Wendy has also been one of my interviewees in these podcasts. You'll be pleased to know. So somewhere I've chosen some of the right people. So one of the reasons why I've been running courses for women in leadership is because women often are relatively overlooked, and various things like the gender pay gap suggest that's the case. Do you think that you can identify any times when you were treated differently because you were female, or have you never noticed?
I think if you're saying recently, I think working in the NHS recently, I think that's not so much the case. But I think if you go back to when I started, so I trained in the 80s, graduated in 91 in Glasgow. So I once thought about this for a while and realised I hadn't actually worked for a female consultant until my first SHO job. So until 12 years after graduation, and I'd never actually been trained by a female consultant. That didn't mean there wasn't female consultants in Glasgow at the time. It's just that I had never been under their rotation. However, my medical year was 50% women, which was the same as medical school intake at that point in time. So we were the first year who had 50% female intake. So that was an interesting one. So I kind of came, I wasn't a proper trailblazer, trailblazer. There were women, there just weren't many of them, and they were few and far between. And did I notice, there was a feeling that in order to be appointed, you certainly had to outperform the men. If you performed the same as a bloke in an interview, he'd get the job. An unspoken rule, nobody ever said it, but it was certainly implication. I did at some point hear that, you know, somebody had said to a male colleague, you know, people sitting the MRCP, look at them. There may be 50% women sitting the MRCP part one. In 3 years' time, they'll all have children and be wanting to be GPs, and you will have a chance to get a job. To my male colleague, who I think was pretty pretty fearless to say that to me, because I've never been slow about having an opinion. And so there has been more a kind of unspoken thing. I think when it comes to the gender pay gap, you see it in local awards, you see it in appraisals, you see it in how women write or how women start to write research papers and then get trained. You know, one of my favourite analogies is if you read a local award application from a man, he kind of puts his knickers on over his trousers and saves the world every day. If you read one from a woman, it's very much the team decided, we went by consensus, we supported each other, we helped each other. And you can't always tell the difference because these are anonymized things, but you can get a very high feeling for the gender of the person writing it. Now, is that nature? Is it nurture? I don't know. I know women in medicine often work part-time. They often they often take the burden of the majority of caring responsibilities. Not always, but they often do. So I think their bandwidth to participate and their bandwidth to blow their own trumpet is less. And in many ways, if they see things improving that they've contributed to, they feel that that is recognition in itself. I don't buy into that, but this is what you feel from some women. So when you say the gender pay gap, it was mainly around, from my understanding, mainly around other roles when people negotiate work for example, being a CD. Now, it never occurred to me to negotiate to be the CD. It was what was offered, the pay was what was offered, I'd take it or I wouldn't take it. And I think that's a tricky one. It's how you get people to value that. I think I've always worked in a very highly feminized specialty. So we have had many women. There are something like our current trainee intake was 73% women. Our current female across the patch of clinical oncology, 66% of us are women. I think when I went part-time for the first time when I became president, I'm about the only woman I know who doesn't work full-time. Who worked full time at that point, who doesn't work less than full time. So I think it's interesting. I chose a specialty that I enjoyed and I liked, but there were always women there.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? The culture within a specialty sometimes seems to shine through, doesn't it? And I assume that you recognised a gentle, but you know, one shouldn't stereotype. So we're gearing towards the end now and thinking of women that might be coming through. What would you say to women who are aspiring to be like you, to be women leaders? What should they do? What advice would you give them?
I think if you're aspiring to do it, then take every opportunity to do it. Don't necessarily wait for opportunities to appear. Try and find opportunities proactively. Don't be surprised if things don't work out and everything's not perfect, because it is hard. I think leading is hard. Doing any sort of leadership role is hard. Managing people and managing doctors, if you ever get into that role, is hard. I think practice those skills. You have skills in that area. Even if you think you don't, practice those skills, because they get better the more you practice. And I think it's also a bit about don't think the imposter syndrome is a phrase I never came across until very recently. But to me, it's not about that. It's about you can do it. You just need to think about it. You need to challenge yourself to go up to the next level. I think find good friends, find people who will give you good advice and honest advice and constructive criticism and listen to them. But have a support network that you can go to who can support you when things are not great. And things are always, there's always some times when things are not great. But also have people who will be honest with you, I think, is the important thing.
That's excellent. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for your time. I better let you get back to running medicine.
It's a busy job, Jane. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Medical Women Talking. It's been a privilege to spend time with all these medical women. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this season. Don't forget, there are many other interviews in season 1.